Welcome to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there,
and
folks.
You can...
God!
It's a running joke.
It's a running
joke.
You
have
now
to know the show to understand the running joke. You can listen online at kpft.org. You can also donate to support this station at kpft.org. And just in terms of sort of doing the initial business of the show, we're recording this early on Sunday morning, May 3rd. It is a pre-recorded show. I miss my callers, but unfortunately, if you call, there's just no one to answer. In terms of election business, the next election in Harris County is July 14th. It's a runoff election. Make sure you're registered to vote. The Harris County Clerk's Office is also closed, at least in person. Probably the easiest way to do business there online, much of which can be done online, is to simply go to harrisvotes.com. The clerk website is too complicated for me to say on the air. Let's see. I think that the first order of business that I'm going to discuss... Oh, and remember, July 15th, new tax deadline. Just kind of helpful. Okay. This is a little off the normal track for the show, but I think that because of the era in which we are living, I got this email. It's a promotional email from Pep Boys Auto Parts Auto Store. And I think it's timely because it's called Tips for Maintaining Your Parked Vehicle. Now, I know we normally do politics and stuff, but I think a lot of us right now are like, is my battery dead? Should I start the car? Is it a good idea to start the car? So here are some things that come out of this email from Pep Boys that I think are worth noting. First of all, keep your tires inflated. Why? Because if they start to lose air and go flat, it deforms the tires. They begin to remember the shape. So it is important that you keep them properly inflated. And this is why when cars go into long-term storage, they put them up on blocks so that the tires don't deform. So,
oh, okay. All right.
Tire
prints. Didn't know that.
Yeah, you see old person knowledge. So, tire stuff. Batteries. What they recommend is at least once a week, start your vehicle. They suggest drive it around the block to get the fluids moving through the engine and get the vehicle up to a proper temperature. Now, here's the thinking behind that. There are people that will simply start the car to kind of make sure it starts, and then they'll turn it off. That is a bad idea. A, you're taking more power to start the engine than you're recharging by running the engine. B, you're not giving like your oil pump and your coolant pump and things like that time to circulate the engine. There used to be an oil commercial that said the worst thing you can do to your engine is start it. Because when you first start your engine, especially if it's been sitting in the driveway, all of the lubricants have literally drained back down into the oil pan.
Yeah.
Starting the engine, you have to give the oil pump time to start the lubricants. Otherwise, all you're doing is running metal against metal for a very short time, draining your battery and damaging your engine.
Yeah, I thought I heard somewhere that there's a lot of machinery that usually in the professional spaces that companies will just leave on because it's harder on the actual machinery to turn it back on again than it is to just leave it running.
That's actually true of a lot of things. You know, when you talk about incandescent light bulbs,
yeah,
if you're going to leave the room for a minute, you might think that you're saving, you know, 1/100th of a kilowatt of electricity, but also the worst thing you can do to a light bulb is turn it on.
Yeah.
that surge of power going through it, because light bulbs typically don't have surge suppressors. Mm. That surge is the hardest part on a light bulb. When you hear light bulbs that have been running for 50 years, it's because they've never been turned off.
Hmm.
It's the turning on. If you remember, it's very unusual for a light bulb to just be on and suddenly go off.
Yeah.
Usually you flip the switch on and it flashes and it's gone.
Mm.
That's the power surge.
Okay.
A little equivalence here. Yeah. So you want to turn on the engine. You want to run it long enough so that you're putting more power into the battery than you're taking out by starting it. You want to give it a chance to recirculate the lubricants, because those lubricants have mostly drained out of your engine while it's been sitting in the driveway. And you do want to get it up to a proper operating temperature, because running a cold engine is also very stressful on it mechanically.
Hmm.
Another thing is various charging implements that you have plugged into your car.
Yes.
What they call micro drains.
Yes.
You might only have an LED that tells your charger when you're in the car that there's power going through it. Mm-hmm. And not all receptacles turn off with the car. There are some that are always on. So if you have a charger plugged into your car that has even this little LED taking a tenth of a watt, when you're leaving it in your driveway, it's draining your battery.
Yeah, yeah.
So those are just things to keep in mind.
And the same thing is true for, like, electronics that are plugged into your home. Like those, you know, little power LEDs that are red, you know, when the thing is turned off.
What they call power vampires.
Exactly, exactly.
But unplugging everything in your house can make you nuts.
Exactly. In the UK, they have switches on wall sockets to turn them off, to turn the actual power at the socket off. And that's a lot more practical than just unplugging everything. Because, I mean, granted, you could accidentally hit a wall socket power switch with your toe and turn your computer off, like I once did in the middle of a very important paper I was writing, and I lost everything.
Save often.
But, you know, it's still not necessarily a bad idea to have switches on plugs, and I'm kind of a little disappointed that we don't do that over here.
Well, we have power strips that have switches.
Yeah, that's true.
And,
okay, fair enough.
You know, TVs used to have instant on capability, and many of them still do, but the recommendation is that you actually leave it off, because for the extra few seconds that it takes to turn on, you're actually saving quite a bit of power cumulatively by not having all your circuits constantly warm.
Yeah.
But again, the same warning goes into the power surge if you don't have a surge protector, which you ought to, that when you first turn any electronic device on, it's like starting your engine is the worst thing you can do. There is that moment when you first start it up, whether it's a hard drive or the solid state electronics or whatever. But anyhow, moving on. This is one I never knew about. Avoid using your parking brake.
Okay.
Now, the parking brake, a.k.a. the emergency brake, is not hydraulic. It is cable-actuated. That means that if you lose your hydraulic pressure, if your brake lines are cut, if you have a leaky master cylinder, your parking brake, your emergency brake, is the thing that is physically actuated. It is not a fly-by-wire. At least it's not supposed to be.
Right.
So the point they make, which I had never thought of, is that if you apply the parking brake for extended periods of time, unless you are on the kind of incline that really requires it, it is possible over time that this parking brake will freeze because it is a physical piece of mechanics.
Yeah.
And it may not release when you want it to release, which suddenly becomes a maintenance issue.
Yeah. Hmm. That is interesting. I mean,
I had never thought of it.
Yeah, I mean, my current car doesn't have a parking brake. My last car did, or at least not like a hand-operated one that, you know, you crank in the, well, not crank, but you pull in the, like, middle of the driver's seat or whatever. But
my father used to have his crank cars, I'm just saying.
Well, I, you know.
Just saying.
Yeah.
Born in 1917, you know.
Yeah. I didn't think about the parking brake like at all, but it makes sense. I mean, it kind of makes sense to me that it isn't fly-by-wire as well, because anything that is fly-by-wire, there is the theoretical possibility that it could get hacked into, depending on, you know, your car's networking capabilities.
Or just fail. I have a new car, and I think one of the things about it that disturbs me, and being an old school guy, I guess there's a lot that disturbs me on a new car, although some of it is very cool, is that the so-called parking brake or emergency brake is a push button that I believe then electronically actuates the physical parking brake.
Right, okay.
Which means that there is an electronic point of failure.
Yes.
Now, that said, and since there's nothing I can do about it, and I'm not saying this as a recommendation because I am not an expert on these things. This is just driving experience, so, you know, don't sue me or anything.
Right.
But some points I have made to my wife relating around parking brakes. Sometimes you'll hear about car defects where they suddenly start to accelerate on their own.
Yes.
Or in the movies, you know, suddenly you have a brake failure and the pedal is going to the floor and you're going downhill and like Clearwater Valley in L.A. or whatever. Mm. This is really the kind of thing that emergency brakes are made for.
Mm.
So if you have a sudden acceleration, now, of course, keep in mind, it might be a good idea to turn off the engine if you have sudden unplanned acceleration.
Yes.
But, of course, that will change the way your power steering handles. So you have to be prepared for the fact that it will work, but it will be much, much harder to turn.
Right,
so
okay.
You can turn off the engine if your car starts to accelerate out of control.
Okay.
Also, you can downshift into first gear.
Right.
Which you don't want to normally do in an automatic transmission when you're kind of going, but what it will do is make your car wheels turn much slower for the number of revolutions of your engine.
Mm, okay.
And you have the emergency brake, which won't be a nice, soft, easy stop. But you can, if you have a runaway car because of a brake failure or whatever, you can apply that emergency brake and between your seatbelt and any airbags, and just because you don't want to have a runaway car, that is what that brake is for. So remember, that is what that brake is for. And if you think about that and have that in your head, if, God forbid, you ever need it, you will have pre-thought of it.
Yeah. So turn your engine off, apply the parking brake. Those are your options. Downshift is also another option.
So some mixture of those things, depending on the circumstance. Yeah, but if you've thought about them in advance, then it won't be a suddenly strange idea if the emergency crops up. That's always my philosophy.
Yeah.
About oil changes. Mm. You know, oil changes are miles or time. Because oil does break down, just like gasoline does. When you watch a show like The Walking Dead, and they're still driving cars, and it's like, haven't the batteries gone dead yet? And if the batteries haven't gone dead, hasn't the gasoline decomposed?
Yeah.
Because gasoline, they tell you, you know, after like 6 months, it needs to be disposed of. Really, it probably won't work very well.
Yeah.
So oil, similar. It will break down over time, exposure to air and whatnot. So if you really are going to leave that car sitting for a long time, God help us if that's necessary, you do need to pay attention to how long that oil has been in your car and check your manual to see how often in time.
Yeah.
It might need to be replaced. So there's that.
Those cars that they use in the post-apocalypse TV shows and movies, if they're gasoline powered, they're probably not going to be much use. But after a little while, I think if you could figure out a hand cranking system, you could probably charge an electric car's battery, and that might be useful.
Yeah, but again, now we're sort of getting off the path, which admittedly is what we do. When you see people like in The Walking Dead looking for a car that they can use to go somewhere or escape something, generally speaking, they're not going to get down into the starter motor and try to figure out a way to turn it into a hand-cranked vehicle.
Yeah.
Which I have to say is something I have not seen them do, which is a great idea.
Yeah, I mean,
they haven't done it.
They probably get eaten by zombies while they're trying, but it would be
a fun experiment. They have safe spaces. You know, they have some walls and communities and whatnot. So they could actually start to take apart some of these cars and make them manually started, which was more the routine up until the 1930s when they came up with electrical starters.
Yes.
Another thing, two more things, and I think these are going to be fairly quick. Sunshades. Now, I am not the kind of guy that's always putting sunshades up in my car every time I park it. But you're talking about a car that's going to be sitting for a while, that's going to be exposed to the same sunrise and sunset every day for days and weeks, A sunshade to protect your dashboard and some of the vinyls and plastics and whatnot may not be a bad idea to start considering if the car is mainly sitting.
Yeah, okay, okay.
And last but not least, windshield wipers. Mm. We know that over time they dry out from UV, they oxidize, they get brittle, they start to break up, they don't do their job, and of course you right. don't know that until you need them to do their job. Apparently, the recommendation is that every once in a while, maybe when you're starting your car, run the windshield wiper fluid for a few seconds. Wash the window and helps to keep the blades from drying out.
Okay.
So, I mean, these are all good ideas. And yeah. We've spent about 14 minutes talking about cars. But we have. But, I used to be kind of a car guy. I used to know, like, the makes and the models and all that stuff. And it's all beyond me now. There are too many.
Oh, okay. But, welcome to Car Talk on KPFT.
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, I think that this is actually some of the most useful information you can get right now that probably no one else is discussing unless you're listening to a car show.
I mean, I will be honest. I think we've spent about 10 more minutes on this than I expected. So, but yeah, it's important information.
I think it's really timely and important information, and it's not top of mind stuff.
Yeah.
Next item. Oh, and actually, I guess because of where we are on the show, I should mention that you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig, and my co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Yes, I do it at the beginning of the show, not the middle of the show.
I know that. I'm just giving you a shot.
Okay, fair enough.
To show you that I remember.
Okay, I appreciate
it. And you are listening to KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. KPFT.org is how you find out what's going on with the station, the programming, and also how you can contribute to support the station if you have the means at this particular time. Any amount, large or small, is greatly appreciated.
And you can listen online there.
And you can listen online, which you may very well be doing right now in any case. Also, I might mention that I post everything I talk about and a great many things I don't have time to talk about on my website, thinkwingradio.com. I generally post the links to the articles so you can validate at least the foundation of what I'm saying. Also, I'm on Twitter at Think Wing Radio and on Facebook, Think Wing Radio, just not original.
Okay. Yes, I'm also on Twitter at DominateI, pronounced DominateI. My Tumblr is also there. I use that more often. Click that if you want to follow me there.
Point of reference, I don't think that you care how people pronounce it as long as they can find it.
I know. Just saying. It matters to me, though.
That's an obsessive compulsive thing.
Maybe it is, but it's my obsessive compulsive thing.
Yes, I know. We all are guilty of them to one degree or another. Okay, next thing. And again, I'm interested in science. I'm interested in technology. I don't talk about it much on the show because it's kind of not the format. But space, this is the article name. This is from TechCrunch. SpaceX and NASA are breakdown in the article, their historic first astronaut mission. Essentially, this will be sometime later this month of May. This will be the first time that the United States has launched astronauts into orbit from U.S. soil since 2011. Mm-hmm. So this is actually a very momentous thing.
Yeah.
It's going to be the Dragon capsule from SpaceX. It'll go up on a Falcon rocket. And essentially, this, while it's a mission, it's also the first man-rated mission, so it's sort of also an experimental flight. Actually, it's called a demo mission. Whether the astronauts will stay there, it's two men. Whether they'll stay there for any length of time or come right back hasn't been decided yet. A lot depends on the performance of the capsule and the other elements of the mission. But this is actually a big thing.
Yeah.
And if this works, and if it goes smoothly, this will be literally the beginning of a new era for the United States in space that's been almost 10 years in the making. Yeah. I do want to point out that even though the last shuttle mission was flown in 2011, the shuttle program was canceled by George W. Bush. It was just too far advanced in its cancellation phase for Obama to renew the program, hence no capability to launch anybody into orbit.
Right. Yeah, I'm not enamored with the idea of public-private partnership in terms of space travel. In fact, I'm not enamored with the idea of privatized space travel at all, really. But I mean, you know, the fact that NASA is going to be launching people into space again is interesting and fun, and, you know, I like it. But there's room to criticize, you know, the privatization of space, but is this the story to do it in? I don't know.
Well, I don't think this is the story to do it in. I think it's a legitimate question, and, you know, I, as a space enthusiast literally as far back as I can remember, and that's pretty far back. I mean, it really is 20 months old. But I think that there are places for privatization and there are places for public ownership or public management. I mean, the fact is that NASA has always been a public-private partnership.
Yeah, there's that. There is that.
It's always been contractors. It's been NASA specifications. I think the difference here, this is a different kind, and I think this is a legitimate topic for this story. This is a different kind of public-private partnership because this is not NASA giving specifications to private contractors who then build to NASA specifications.
Right.
This is NASA saying these are minimum performance requirements. How you accomplish them is up to you.
Yes.
In a way, it's a little like a military contract for a new fighter aircraft.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you know, we expect it to have this kind of range and this kind of payload capacity and these kinds of long-range avionics and show us something.
Yeah.
That's pretty much how, like, the Air Force does it, and in many ways not dissimilar from the way the Navy does it.
Yeah. And,
or the Army, for that matter.
And, I mean, drawing comparisons between the military and NASA is something that also scares me, because the militarization of space definitely scares me.
Well, of course, you realize that we wouldn't have NASA if it didn't have a military application.
That's absolutely true. So,
you know, we have a civilian space program because we had a military need for a space program.
Yeah, the links are already there. This public-private partnership stuff is not the originator of the links between NASA and the military. Those can and should be criticized and, you know, examined, but they're not the fault of SpaceX, at least.
You want a little bit of space trivia?
Sure.
The space shuttle was called America's Space Truck.
Okay.
Because it was originally intended to ship payloads. It's just that after the Challenger explosion, they decided that having rockets in the payload bay may not have been the best idea.
Ah, yes.
But that was the original vision, was to bring payloads to low Earth orbit that could then boost themselves into higher Earth orbit, and that the whole process would be less expensive because that first booster would be reusable.
Right.
The shuttle.
So payloads as in, like, not military payloads, although not necessarily not military payloads.
All kinds of payloads.
All satellites, kinds of payloads.
Top secret military satellites. Because that was, okay, let me back up a little bit. The original space shuttle concept was a space shuttle to an orbiting space station.
Oh.
And it was meant to take maybe 7 people at a time. Mm-hmm. It was essentially a large space capsule with wings. There used to be a project called Project Dinosaur, D-Y-N-A, Dynamic Soaring, from the 1950s. And this was essentially an expansion of that. It was like lifting bodies and the whole bit. But it was essentially just a manned, winged, reusable spacecraft to go to and from a space station. Mm. Nixon, who I blame for destroying the American space program effectively for 20 years, Nixon didn't have any interest in space except for its military and security applications. And NASA couldn't get the funding for just a personnel space shuttle, let alone a space station.
Right.
So the military said, well, we'll be happy to contribute to the funding out of our budget if you can ship stuff to space.
Yeah.
So instead of being a personal transport, it became a space truck. Which changed all the logistics of how it gets there.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden you needed bigger engines. You needed solid rocket boosters. It changed everything.
Yeah.
By the time they had this shuttle built, and originally it was supposed to be all reusable. You're supposed to have a reusable booster and then a reusable shuttle. And they decided they couldn't afford to make the reusable booster that would land on a runway. So they had the disposable part of it.
Hmm.
And what happened by the time they finally got a shuttle, they didn't have the money for a space station. So now you had a shuttle with really no place to go.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Skylab was supposed to be reboosted into a higher orbit by the shuttle, which ran so far behind schedule that we lost Skylab.
Huh.
This is all interrelated. It's all very interesting stuff. It's all here.
Yeah.
Go back and find it.
Yeah.
So we ended up with a shuttle with no place to go and eventually ended up with a space station with no way to get there.
Mm.
So this is the irony of space history.
Mm. Yeah.
Just saying, because, you know, we brought that up.
Yeah.
I like to think this is a place to get random information. This is
That's what I like about the show.
Thank you. That's what I like about the show, too. Next item. This is from Newsweek. British doctors say ventilators purchased from China could kill coronavirus patients. Now, we've heard about defective tests being imported from China. We've heard about defective masks and ventilators being imported from Russia. And apparently, these ventilators that came from China pose, quote, a significant patient harm, including death, according to a letter seen by NBC News. Apparently, there are problems with the basic quality of the ventilators. The oxygen supply is variable and unreliable. Doctors are unfamiliar with the machines, which basically is a training issue, but there was no training. I seem to recall there's also a problem with sterilization because of the way the machines are made. Also, apparently, they were intended for use in ambulances and not hospitals, so that makes them a very different kind of beast.
Right.
So this, in my mind, goes back to, I think, an argument that many people have been making, some liberals, some conservatives, different reasons, that domestic production capability of certain things is essential. That doesn't mean we shouldn't trade. That doesn't mean we shouldn't buy things from overseas, but it does mean that we need to preserve domestic capacity that can be ramped up to make things that we need, like, you know, masks. Mm. I mean, we actually don't have really capacity to make something as simple as surgical masks. We used to have an enormous textile industry, a lot of it in North Carolina. That's why a lot of North Carolina now is unemployed, because so much of that moved overseas. So, I mean, there's a balance here. Trade is good from an economic standpoint, a consumer standpoint, a capitalist standpoint, a strategic international relations standpoint, but so does domestic capability, in my opinion, to make things, to retain the know-how to make things, and to be able to ramp up the production to make things. I'm going to say joke, but it's sort of an ironic joke. You know, the United States during the First and Second World War had the nickname the Arsenal of Democracy. Unfortunately, we've exported the Arsenal of Democracy to China.
Hmm.
So, just, you know, something to think about.
Yeah, definitely. I want to point out something about the first quote that you, not the first quote that you read, the second quote that you read. Mm-hmm. The letter details serious concerns over the basic quality. That reads to me as basic quality, as in not as in the the lowest level quality, but of the actual machine. But the,
in other words,
the machine
not the
is basic quality.
Yeah, not the sophistication of the design, just the way it is built.
Yeah, the design is not sophisticated.
Yeah, I don't think it says that. I think what they're talking about is the basic manufacturing quality.
Okay,
how is it welded? How is it soldered? How is it riveted? How is it screwed together? Are there screws missing? Are there screws stripped? We're talking the basic manufacturing quality is what I infer. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Just wanted to point that out, make sure we're all on the same page about
that. That's cool. That's, I think, one of the things that's great about having you.
Mm.
You see? compliment.
Yes.
Now, because this show is basically planned 2 days before it's broadcast, there are current events that I try to avoid that may be overtaken by time. So this one particular piece, which I got from the Business Insider, and you can go to my website when I post this and click on the link and read the story. But the title is Trump calls protesters who carried guns into the Michigan Capitol, quote, very good people, unquote, and says the governor should make a deal with them. Now, I don't know what this story is going to look like in 2 days, or if anyone will be talking about it, or if it's overcome by other amazing stuff that's happened. But this harkens back to the Charlottesville protests, where Trump called both sides very good people. So the white supremacists and the Nazis and the other folks that were on the Trump-supporting side, they were very good people. And also the people on the left who were being assaulted by the people.
Yes, the counter-protesters, Antifa, those people are also very good people, which...
They're all very good people.
Yes, and, apparently.
And, you know, I think from my opinion, I'm a New Yorker originally. I carry my political ethnicity with me, as I think we all do as we grow up. Mm. When I see people carrying guns in a public space, I go in the other direction. Mm. And when I, especially these days, and when I hear about people carrying long guns into a Capitol building, into a government building, doesn't that strike, I mean, I guess there are people it doesn't strike as insane, but doesn't that strike most people as insane?
Yeah, it's not a thing you want to happen, surely, most people. I mean, in these, I mean, this is a very good example of the fact that both sidesism, you know, and as much as this is an extreme example of it, a very extreme example.
False equivalence, I think, is
false equivalence
you're looking for.
Yes, yes, those are. But both sides is it. Both sides is also a thing. It's a term that people would recognize.
Yeah,
it's just not a very good idea. I mean, you know, you have on one side you have people who are, you know, calling for the subjugation and elimination of certain groups of people, and you have the people who say, no, that's wrong, and we're going to defend those groups of people if you try to do anything. And you have politicians, I use that term, well, I don't know if I use it loosely.
They are politicians.
They are politicians. Trump is a politician. Yeah. Politicians like Trump who go, oh, no, we should, this is, you know, both of these people are good, and they both have good points, and, you know, it's, I mean, it makes it obvious when there's this kind of dichotomy between the two sides. That
dichotomy, you mean?
Dichotomy, thank you. I can't speak today.
Okay, it's 2 a.m. for
it's
us.
It's 2 a.m, yeah. It's obvious in this kind of dichotomy which side he's actually trying to support, I think.
There was a point I was going to make on this.
Sorry, I just destroyed that, didn't I?
That's okay. That's why I interrupt. It's not to be rude. It's so I don't forget the short-term thing that's in my head.
Yeah.
This was one of the points I wanted to make. That, you know, when politicians in these various red states started to pass laws about open carry and concealed carry, and they always excluded the right to carry in the Congress, in the legislature, in the political convention. And it's like, I hope these folks are now feeling that this is getting much closer to home. This is sort of the inevitability slippery slide issue. Once you unleash something, how much control do you have over where it goes? So now they have people carrying assault style weapons and handguns into the Michigan Capitol where the legislators are.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope they feel safer.
Yeah. I mean, I think you are making somewhat of a gun control point about this, and that's fine to make. I do want to make it clear, though, my stance on it. I'm not exactly – I don't know exactly where I stand on gun control. I'm not really for it in a lot of the ways that most people are, but I'm not against it in a lot of the ways that most people who are against it are. I mean, I'm for anything that gives marginalized groups the ability to defend themselves.
Ah, okay.
The unfortunate reality.
That brings up the point I wanted to make.
Yeah.
And this is a point that's had to do with my cultural awakening over the last several years because of various videos that have come to light that have shaken my confidence in law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
But also a point that Egberto Willis made when he was engineering my show.
Mm.
And that is that the Second Amendment... The Second Amendment freedoms that these people keep talking about, they're strictly white people's freedoms.
Yes, that's true.
Second Amendment freedoms do not apply to non-white people. And we
that's
have
true.
Seen this over and over again. where people will be stopped by an officer in one case in particular, where he said, officer, is a passenger. He said, officer, I have a gun. I have a permit for the gun. I am going to slowly reach in and take the gun out carefully so you can see it, and I lay it aside, and the guy instantly gets shot.
Yeah.
And this is something we see over and over again, that after the Civil War, there was an argument made by some that guns were the way to keep slaves, former slaves, free because of the way they were persecuted by the Klan and others.
Yes.
And that has now flipped around so that apparently white people feel the need to protect themselves, possibly, perhaps, maybe from non-white people. But non-white people having a gun to protect themselves actually put themselves in greater risk of death.
Yeah, I mean,
so the
I
Second
think...
Amendment, I'm sorry, just one more little point.
Oh, sure,
the
sure,
Second
sure.
Amendment, and I don't know why this point maybe has been made, I don't know, but if you look at the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, the Second Amendment is made unconstitutional, essentially as currently interpreted, by the Equal Protection Rule of the Constitution.
Really?
Well, I mean, you're supposed to have equal protection under the law.
Sure.
As currently interpreted, the Second Amendment is not useful to non-white people. So where is the equal protection?
Let me get this straight. Its terminology, its terminology literally excludes non-white people?
No.
Oh.
But it functionally excludes non-white
people. Okay.
Which, in terms of court law, sometimes is enough.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
The wording of the law doesn't matter if the application of the law is unequal.
Yeah.
So in this particular case, the law theoretically means that anybody can open carry with a license or not. Anybody can concealed carry with a license or not. Anybody can walk into a Walmart or a Target or a Kroger with a long gun, and it's perfectly fine. But the fact is that when you have a black kid who was going to buy a BB gun at a Walmart, took it off the rack and was walking around the store, a white woman said, there is a suspicious black man with a rifle, and the police came in and killed him.
Yeah.
So immediately, there is not equal protection under the Second Amendment, functionally.
This is something I think ought to be brought up in court in an effort to get the language of the Second Amendment changed to be able to be equally applicable. If
first
that's
of all,
possible,
you're talking about changing an amendment, which requires an amendment.
That's true.
And secondly, we are assuming or guessing that this argument has never been made in court. And frankly,
that's also
I do not know whether or not it has been.
But
if it hasn't been, it should be.
Yeah. But regardless, just to reiterate, you know, my stance, marginalized people should have the ability to defend themselves from the people who want to see them dead. And, you know, that's why I support personal gun ownership. But I understand people's fears of, you know, not wanting people to be able to open carry in public. I get that. Like, that is it is terrifying on some level to.
But also to reframe what you just said, while marginalized people may have the same Second Amendment right to defend themselves as majority people.
Right.
What do you do when taking advantage of that right actually puts you in greater danger?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the point.
That's a problem, and it needs to be dealt with. It needs to be addressed so that marginalized people can defend themselves.
Or that they don't need to because gun ownership is more restricted, so you can't just have people randomly going around shooting other people. It's more regulated. Mm. And I don't think anyone... In spite of what many righties think, I don't think there's any reasonable person that talks about outlawing guns or confiscating guns. It's always limiting ownership, licensing ownership, repurchasing weapons, not confiscating them.
Yes.
So there are all of these misconceptions by people who have a vested interest in promoting or having these misconceptions.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the people who do talk about getting rid of all the guns, confiscating all the guns, that sort of thing, are actually people from outside of the U.S., from other countries who have basically banned guns, but most of them do a buyback program, I believe.
Yes, they've all done buyback programs. The democracies have.
Yes, and so, you know, it's... It may be that they don't know the history of the policy in their own countries as well, because it's not been a big deal like it has been over here. But
well, where do you bring up the outside the U.S. situation? I mean, how does that even relate to? I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just asking how that relates to this to the discussion we've been having.
Oh, I just thought it was. You mentioned that it's a misconception brought up by people who have a vested interest in promoting that misconception. I think there's also people who bring up that misconception who don't realize it's a misconception and don't have a vested interest, but they're not people who are in the U.S. They are people from outside the U.S.
Well, I mean, certainly there are external actors that have their own reasons to cause distress and confusion and whatnot in the United States. That's a given.
Yeah.
But there are people who believe that they need guns because they believe that they need guns.
Yes.
You know, circular logic.
Yeah.
There are the gun manufacturers. There are the gun retailers, the gun wholesalers. There are the vested interest groups like the NRA. And while the NRA is the best known pro-gun group, they are not the only one.
They're not.
They are not.
There is also the Socialist Rifle Association.
Didn't know about that. So yeah, again,
a lot of people don't.
Yep. Well, there you go. And there is a smaller equivalent of the NRA, which name I can't remember. It has a much, much smaller membership, but essentially has the same views.
Mm.
So you have these are the vested interests I'm talking about. And then you have the people that have grown up with guns. In some cases, live in rural areas where, you know, police assistance is not something that's readily available.
Right.
So
right.
You've got that. You've got areas where, for example, they've reintroduced wolves. That's a legitimate concern. You've got coyotes in urban areas. Not that I'm advocating shooting coyotes in urban areas. Mm. But, I mean, there are hazards for which you, or even sports, for which you have a legitimate reason to own a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
I think the question is what kinds of firearms being used in what kinds of environments and what kinds of situations by what kinds of people.
I do just want to quickly as well, because I've spotted something in my own speech that I also want to clarify, just to make absolutely clear. Mentioning the Socialist Rifle Association in the same breath as the NRA and other associations like that is perhaps painting them in a light that I don't want to paint them in. I don't have a problem with them. I think they're fine. I haven't done a whole lot of research into them,
because
but I'm not aware.
We've spent much more time on this than I expected.
We have.
Does the Socialist Gun Association? What is it called again, precisely?
Socialist Rifle Association.
Okay.
I believe.
What exactly are their policy objectives, and how do they differ, if at all, from the NRA? Because now this is something totally new to me, and I'm curious.
I'm not sure that they do have policy objectives, is the thing. I think they may exist mainly to educate people about guns, to help them understand how they can be used for their defense, for marginalized groups, mainly. And
you know, that's what the NRA used to be known for, right?
That's what they used to be known for, but what they used to be known for, what they claim to be known for, and what they are actually known for, different things.
Which is why I think it's legitimate to ask what the policy objectives of the Socialist Rifle Association are. And I'm not.
Yeah, it's. Oh, I'm not saying.
I'm not in any way trying to demean them by, you know, emphasizing Socialist Rifle Association, but it's a legitimate question. They are an organization that presumably has policy goals, whether it's education or something else like the NRA.
Yeah.
I'm just curious to the extent you may know, or somebody may look it up because now they're curious too.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's a legitimate question. I just don't know of any specific like legislation goals that they have, because the NRA does have legislation goals.
Yeah.
I think the SRA's policy is basically just teach people how to use guns, but teach them how to use them defensively and teach them how to use them safely. And as far as I know,
that's a policy objective.
That's fair. But it's not necessarily a legislative objective.
And
I think that matters.
I don't know anything about them, so this is all guesswork. But I would guess that if they have a policy objective, on some level that becomes a legislation objective, either for or against.
Possibly. Okay. Anyway, maybe we should
time
get
for
off
a station. I'm sorry?
Maybe we should get off the
subject, which is why I'm going to do a station break. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM. KPFT Houston. You can follow the station at kpft.org. You can find out about programming. We're doing all of this now remotely because that's the age we live in.
Yep.
So some shows are running archives. Many shows like this one are being done weekly or daily. So there's a whole lot to know about what's going on at KPFT and what kinds of events are either being sponsored by KPFT or for KPFT. There are fundraisers that go on, many of them now virtual, I might add. I keep forgetting that. You can also follow my show at thinkwingradio.com, Twitter at thinkwingradio, Facebook thinkwingradio, and of course, Andrew has his thing.
I do. I'm on Twitter at DominateI, that's E-Y-E, pronounced Dominate I, or pronounced...
It doesn't matter how it's pronounced. They
dang
just
it.
Spell it right.
Written, it is written Dominate E-Y-E, pronounced Dominate I. My Tumblr is also there. I use that more. There we go. That's my
stubborn
message. Sorry. It's just, I've got to get it down. Once I get it down, it'll be fast.
I guess when I remember that you're my co-host and not my guest host, and when I remember that you need to say hello after I say your name, maybe by that time you'll have remembered that it doesn't matter how it's pronounced as long as they spell it right.
So we've got things to work on.
We've got stuff to work on. That just makes us human. Okay, next topic. This is actually kind of an interesting article. This is from grist.org. The world is on lockdown, so where are all the carbon emissions coming from? Fair question. So as excerpts from the article say, pedestrians have taken over city streets. People have almost entirely stopped flying. Skies are bluer even in Los Angeles. Global CO2 emissions are on track to drop by 5.5%. 5.5%. So even with the global economy at a near standstill, the best analysis suggests that the world is still on track to release 95% of the carbon dioxide emitted in a typical year, continuing to heat up the planet. So they go into some numbers in the article. Transportation makes up 20% of carbon emissions. Let's see. And I'm actually losing my place here. They go into some other numbers. Electricity and heating account for 40% of global emissions. And then in the United States, 60% of electricity is still generated from coal, oil, and natural gas. But here's the scary part. With everybody, with so many people staying home, with so many businesses and industries closed down, we have only reduced carbon emissions by 5.5%. And in order to keep global warming to a limit of 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is almost 3 degrees Fahrenheit, we would need to cut carbon emission by 7.6% every year. Now, what that means, and Andrew and I had this discussion, that means this year we would have to cut carbon emissions 7.6% from what it was in 2019.
Yeah.
In 2021, we would have to cut it another 7.6% from what it was in 2020 and on down the line. So between 2020 and 2030, the goal would be to decrease carbon emissions by about 50%. And bringing the world to a standstill, we have managed a grand total of 5.5%.
Yeah.
That's got to be scary. And that goes to show just what kind of obstacles we have to confront just in the effort.
Yeah. I mean, the article goes into, it talks about how manufacturing, construction, and other types of industry are about 20% of global CO2 emissions.
And by the way, there's also a link to another article embedded in this that actually
yes.
goes into a lot of granular detail, which is
interesting. Yes. There's a link to the report, I believe, that
yes.
The UN report.
Where it says cut by 7.6% every year, that every year part has the link to that article.
Yes. But this bit about manufacturing being 20% of emissions, I mean, this kind of I sent this email to Mike because I read
yes,
it.
Yes, this was Andrew's find.
And found, oh, this can support my argument that, industry and work are the majority of, the majority responsible for climate change. This isn't just industry because, again, according to the numbers, that is only 20%. But this is, also retail stores. This is office jobs and that sort of thing.
This now, is the heating. This is cooling. This
is
lighting.
And the article mentions that though electricity usage has shifted from offices to homes, it hasn't gone down that.
It just rearranges the consumption.
It's just rearranged. That's true. But I do think it might go down if work days are shorter. I think if people had to do less intensive tasks, they would have to use fewer devices, perhaps, or use devices with lower energy footprints, and that could make emissions go down, because that could make electricity usage go down. This is speculation. This is opinion. That is my general opinion about this sort of thing, is that if we can find a way to reduce work days, if we can find a way to reduce production, then we would reduce emissions. And that would help us on our way to addressing climate change.
Well, production is ultimately a function of demand. Demand, of course, is a function of earnings. And earnings are a function of work.
Yes, but we do overproduce.
Well,
I mean, a significant number of the things that we produce in our economy don't get sold. They get thrown in the trash because they expire or they're not new anymore.
There's supply chain issues and whatnot, yes.
Yeah.
But I will point out something that I haven't mentioned in quite a while, and that is the definition of durable goods.
I
think this is sort of related to this topic. I remember very, very clearly, into the 80s at least, durable goods were defined as products designed to last 10 years or more.
Okay.
So appliances, cars, things like that.
Sure.
Those were considered durable goods. Non-durable goods were things designed to last perhaps a year. Around the 80s, and it's hard to find validation of this online, but my memory of it is so clear, I have no doubt. Sometime around the 80s, for various reasons, the definition of durable goods was changed to products designed to last 5 years or more.
Right.
And somewhere around 2000-ish, that definition was changed to durable goods or products designed to last 3 years or more.
Mm.
And if you want to really be appalled, non-durable goods are products designed to last 90 days or more.
Oh.
Now,
why?
What's the trade-off? Well, when you bought something designed to last 10 years or more, because manufacturers sold fewer of them less often,
yes,
they were more expensive.
Sure.
And that made them worthwhile to repair.
Yes.
As the durable goods definition went down, and as products were designed to the durable goods definition increasingly effectively with the use of computers,
mm-hmm,
so now a washing machine that used to last 20 years that was designed for 10 might last 8 years that was designed for 5, or 5 years
right,
that was designed for 3.
Right.
And if there's one thing we've learned, is that there isn't a circuit board you can buy for a device that costs less than $300 plus labor. So when you, and they have 90-day warranties on them.
Yes.
So what you end up doing is you're buying what still seems like an expensive product. You can spend $1,000, $2,000 on a good washing machine. But when you compare that to what that used to cost you in adjusted dollars in 1960,
mm-hmm,
that was it was several hundred dollars, but it was a very expensive machine for several,
yes,
hundred dollars.
Yes.
So it paid to repair it.
Yes.
And you produced fewer of them, which means less consumption of resources, less energy input.
Yeah.
It was cost effective to repair them, so when something went wrong, you fixed it and it lasted longer, basically until it rotted away or something irreparable happened.
Yeah.
Whereas now, you can throw away what is effectively a perfectly good machine. Of course, they go into rebuild and sell used, but you can throw away what is effectively a perfectly good machine except for the absence of a working circuit board.
Yes.
Which is $300 plus labor.
Yeah.
So the trade-off is, in my opinion, as my lay mind has kind of worked out, if
sure,
you were to make machines that had a durable goods definition of 10 years, they would cost much more.
Mm.
Obviously, people would need to earn more to afford them, or they,
yes,
would have to simply do without and buy lower grade equipment.
Yeah.
But you would have less recycling.
Yes.
You would have more jobs, because you would have fewer manufacturing jobs, perhaps, but you would have more service and technical jobs to repair the machines.
Mm. Yeah.
So, I mean, there are different balances. So,
yes,
going back to your point, because I don't like to get too diverted.
When
you talk about doing things more efficiently or having people work fewer hours, I mean, as an old school guy, I see problems with that immediately. I mean, I'm kind of, you know, I'm an old school guy,
right?
Literally and figuratively. But that doesn't mean you can't do things differently. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean, for example, as in many countries, social democracies, instead of laying people off, you simply reduce everybody's hours. So you have more job sharing, which costs less unemployment insurance, because now you're only making up the difference between a productive job and what you would earn if you were working full hours. I mean, there are all kinds of social and economic implications that other countries have experienced and experimented with that we could learn from.
Mm-hmm.
But to our point now, trying to cut carbon and only succeeding at 5.5%, well, first of all, I would say it's easy to be discouraged, but every little bit helps.
Yes.
So, you know, 1% is not as good as 3%, but it's better than zero.
Yeah.
The other thing is, we are learning that there are more things we can do remotely. We are learning that there are things that we can do driving our cars less, burning less petroleum, which has its own backflow effects in terms of the environment and economics. It's like renewable energy. Okay, sure, you'll be pumping less oil. There'll be fewer jobs in the oil field. There'll be fewer jobs in refining. But then you have jobs manufacturing the renewable energy equipment and servicing it and installing it. So yeah. It's not a zero-sum game. There is actually an overall advantage to be gained and a disadvantage to be suffered no matter what you do.
Yeah. And just to kind of wrap up here, I think,
yeah.
There is an update at the bottom of this article. As of April 30th, the International Energy Agency estimates that carbon emissions will fall by 8% this year. The earlier 5.5% was based on an earlier carbon brief analysis that has now been somewhat out of date. So,
okay. And
better news.
Almost perfectly timed at 56 minutes and a fraction. You have been listening to Thinkwing Radio with Mike Koenig and my co-host Andrew Ferguson. He is also the editor for this show on our pre-recorded format.
Mm-hmm.
This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. We will be back next week. Have a great week.
See you later, folks. Right outside the storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late. We should be giving. Only with love can we climb. It's not too late.
Aloha! In today's complex world, filled with complicated instructions like do this, turn here, don't staple, fold, spindle, tape, or mutilate, one way, etc., etc., why not take a break from all of this? Not near a seashore or relaxing in a tropical paradise. Well, the surf's up over at kpft.org. So mouse on over to kpft.org and pledge and renew online. It's easy, uncomplicated, and will give you that warm and fuzzy feeling of having done something good for yourself and your community. So wax that mouse, hang 10, and surf over to kpft.org and renew your membership and pledge online at kpft.org. Thank you for supporting KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace. Mahalo.
Week we get letters, emails, and phone calls saying thanks. Thanks for playing a piece of music. Thanks for keeping listeners up to date on events in our area. Thanks for introducing our fans to new talent. Now we're asking you to say thanks in a very tangible way. We're asking you to make a pledge. When you